Good afternoon. I'll call the meeting of the Joint House and Senate State Affairs Committee to order. I'll let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday, February 7th. We are having this joint meeting here with the our House counterparts in the State Affairs Committee, and so I'll just first take roll call and introduce present today Senators Klayman, Senator Merrick, Senator Bjorkman, myself, Chair Kawasaki, and I'll turn the gavel over to Chair of the House State Affairs Committee, Representative Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to note for the record that Representative Johnson has an unavoidable conflict with another committee meeting today. The following members of the State House Affairs are present: Representative Carpenter, Representative Allard, Representative Armstrong, Representative Story, Vice Chair Wright, and myself, Representative Shaw. With that, I will return the gavel to Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we start, please silence your cell phones. Thank you. I want to remind members and those who testify that all questions and comments must be directed through the chair. And before testifying, please clearly state your name, title, and affiliation for the record. With us today, I wanted to mention we have Senate records here. Oh, Carrie Cooperrider is back there. I see her now. And we also have a moderator from the Legislative Information Office. On today's agenda, the purpose of today's meeting is to hear from both the Department of Public Safety, Commissioner Jim Cockrell and some colleagues, and Commissioner of Corrections Designee Jen Winkleman, and also her colleagues. We have first Department of Public Safety Commissioner Jim Cockrell. Welcome to the committee.
Through the chair and Chair Shaw, thank you for inviting us here for this hearing. On my right, far right, is Deputy Commissioner Brian Barlow with the Alaska Department of Public Safety, and prior to that, he was the Colonel of the Alaska State Troopers. And I've got Lisa Puritan. She's acting as my liaison running the PowerPoint. If it pleases the chairs, I'd like to just make a kind of an opening statement of where I think we're going as a department, and then we'll get to the PowerPoint. And I would ask that this be a conversation, because I think it's really important that we communicate as a law enforcement agency that represents most of the state of Alaska. And I think it's important that our lawmakers and the public understand what we're doing as a department. So I hope that you guys ask some good questions and we'll try to get the answers for you. Because I know you guys see a lot of PowerPoints during the session. So I'd like to first of all say that, you know, I feel the department has seen a lot of momentum in the last 2 years. And part of that is because of the current governor and also the legislature that certainly has supported us the last 2 years since I've been the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. We've been able to hire more troopers in the last year. We've hired and put 51 troopers through our academy. We still are dealing with retention and vacancies, but we're seeing the positive steps in our recruitment efforts, the incentives that we're offering new troopers. So I feel really comfortable there. Our VPSO program, I think, is the shining star of our department right now. We have zero vacancies. We were funded for, we got 68 positions currently in boots on the ground, and we're funded for 65. So we're really pleased. Our retention rate is at almost 90%, so we're losing less than 10%. A lot of that is factored into the passing of the VPSO bill last year, the additional funding for pay raises for the VPSO program, and the amount of also the support that the legislature gave us by passing about $1 million or almost $2 million in funds to shore up their office spaces and provide equipment that's needed for the VPSO program. So I see that as a huge step forward for our program, and very proud of Colonel Hart and the grantees for the hard work that they've been doing. I will say the department has, again, benefited by the legislature for funding equipment. We've recently purchased or in the process of purchasing and upgrading our tasers. We've certainly probably seen the news about our body-worn cameras. We're moving forward with that. We've actually ordered 600 body-worn cameras for our troopers, deputy fire marshals, court corrections officers, wildlife troopers, and also our VPSOs. We're really excited to do that. We currently have our policies and procedures online for public comment. We'll take public comment for about a month, look at the comments and see if we if there's some areas that we have to address as an agency to meet the requirements or the of our citizens. So I see that as a major step forward. We hope to have everybody in body-worn cameras as a department within this summer or early fall is my goal. It's something that has been important to me since I was a colonel of the Alaska State Troopers. Almost 10 years later, we're finally going to that. And a lot of that, again, we actually got adequate financial support for it. We're in the current of replacing all our police radios. Certainly the Senate was involved in passing that with the capital funds, and we're also upgrading our duty firearms. We're switching from a 40 caliber to 9mm for several good reasons, but in the long run, it's going to reduce the cost of training troopers in because the ammunition is much cheaper, but yet the ballistics are similar to the 40 caliber. So with that said, I see the department going in a positive direction, and it's certainly not because of anything that I've done. It's certainly the things that my staff has done and the commitment to the troopers and support staff that the department has. We have an amazing department. They do amazing things every day. They save lives yearly, and I'm certainly proud of the direction. I'm proud of my troopers. I'm proud of the department. So with that said, I'll start with the PowerPoint unless there's some questions. And it's certainly a pleasure to be able to talk. As you can tell, I love to talk about the department. It's something I've spent 30 years of my life in. My dad's a retired trooper. I went to the academy when Laddie Shaw was down at the academy, so I certainly have some connections.
We do have one question, and then we'll make questions brief until you get through with the presentation. But Senator Klayman has
that was fun. You mentioned that your retention on the VPSRs was 10%, or you were only losing 10%. But what about on the troopers? How are you doing on the retention? Because you're getting the higher and the new, but you've been also consistently confronted with what is your attrition rate and combined with the new hire?
Through the chair, I think I actually have a slide on our retention. Currently, we have 50 vacant trooper positions. 8 of those are wildlife troopers, so 42. I think it's around 15 or 16% of our overall vacancy rate. We're struggling, but we have actually net gained positions based on the last two academies. We have an academy going in February, late February, and we'll graduate in this summer. But I can get you the exact numbers if you want. We certainly have to do better. And, we're looking at different avenues to shore up and provide more support for our troopers where they don't leave the department until they're ready for retirement. So real quickly, I'll kind of go over, I'm not going to go over all our key objectives, but everything that we do with the department, especially our law enforcement parts of it, the wildlife troopers, is based on our key objectives. Every person in our department gets our key objectives so they know exactly where we want to go as a department. And I can answer any questions specifically to that slide. And there's certainly got more detail in your handout. Some of the successes I certainly had touched on. But I will say that in the last year, we hired two long-term non-perm investigators to investigate cold cases of missing, murdered, or indigenous people. I'd like to update that to about 4 based on the amount of feedback we're getting from our indigenous people around the state. We're currently working several cold cases, and hopefully we'll be able to solve a couple homicides that were committed against indigenous women in our state. So I see that as a big success. We've seized 13,425,000 potential fatal doses of illicit fentanyl. I think that as a state, we're averaging about 120 to 130 overdose deaths a year, which is when you go per capita, it leads the nation. We need to do better. We've seen an overall, we can't take credit, this is all law enforcement in the state, but we've seen an overall reduction in crime with our UCR reports at about 15%. And a lot of that is a reflection of our DAs, our court system, and our law enforcement officers around the state. I will say this is a snapshot of 1 year. It doesn't mean a trend, certainly because we still have an outlier with COVID. So probably won't really know what our true affects our till after, I'm sorry.
UCR.
Oh, Uniform Crime Report by the FBI. That's a standardized report that the FBI has utilized since the 1920s that police departments submit their crime data to. We're actually going to the I'm going too far in the weeds. We'll leave that alone for there. So for this one, again, we've sent 51 troopers to the academy. We're expanding our wellness program continuously. We've actually added a mental health specialist for our budget for FY24 ask to continue it. And then we talked about the body-worn cameras. Next slide, a quick organizational thing.
Yep. Commissioner, we just have one question from
yes, sir.
Representative Shaw.
Commissioner, yeah, through the chair. You highlighted the first part of this sheet, long-term, non-perm, for the investigators. Are they civilians, and if so, are primarily retired officers?
Through the chair, Representative Shaw, that's a good question. Essentially, they're retired Alaska State Troopers. They're fully commissioned. We bring them in as a state trooper investigator, so they have the same powers as an Alaska State Trooper investigator. But the positives is bringing in a long-term, non-perm. We can select that person. Doesn't take a person out of our investigative unit or out of the patrol, and they've already got the experience, the training, and we're just basically paying them their general salary. They don't have any benefits and stuff. But it's been very effective.
Thank you, Commissioner.
A real quick organizational chart. Essentially, we have four divisions. They're in your handout. The deputy commissioner runs the Division of Life and Fire, Statewide Services, and the Trooper Academy. We also have four boards and commissions, and I kind of oversee the rest of the department.
Commissioner, we did have a question, I think, from Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. Commissioner Cockrell, thanks for joining us today. I was just wondering, is that increase of investigators from 2 to 4, is that in your budget request for this year?
Through the chair, no, it's not. And again, we don't normally budget for long-term non-perms. We have probably approximately 10 long-term non-perms that are unbudgeted that we pull essentially out from either a vacancy or overtime funding.
Thanks, Commissioner.
And I'll turn it over to the Deputy Commissioner.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. And thanks, everybody, for having us here. For the record, my name is Brian Barlow, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Public Safety. On this slide here, it's kind of a depiction of the Alaska State Troopers or Department of Public Safety area of responsibility. And you can see down the color-coded areas of our detachments or different detachments for the Alaska State Troopers, 8 detachment and being south-central, or rather the Kenai Peninsula in southeast Alaska, B detachment, south central Alaska, D detachment, primarily of interior Alaska, and the western Alaska, or C detachment, serving all of western Alaska and southwest. The uncolored portion is the North Slope borough area. Within our area of responsibility, there's a number of public safety services that we provide to include patrol, our Alaska Bureau of Investigation, which is our major crimes investigative bureau, statewide drug and alcohol investigations, and a number of other support services to include search and rescue coordination, our advanced training unit, which provides continuing education and more advanced training for our troopers and other staff, our recruitment unit, which we spoke about recruitment earlier, a robust effort within our department and ongoing, and prisoner transport as an example for pre-conviction prisoners, as well as dispatch services. We have our own dispatch service in Fairbanks, owned, if you will, by the department, serving interior Alaska, portions of western Alaska and southeast, to include Kodiak Island as well, and two contract centers in south central and the Kenai Peninsula. Next slide, please. So for the Division of Alaska State Troopers, as you can see here, some of the accomplishments and challenges seen by the division. We talked a little bit earlier about drug seizures. Obviously, we've seen a significant increase in the amount of seizures because of some internal changes we've made and focuses, investigative focuses we've had within the division. continue to have a high solve rate for homicides within our jurisdictions, here listed 85%. But I would say that 85% solved and many, many others, or others, if you will, in the investigative process. Expansion of our support in rural Alaska, talked about the expansion of major criminal investigators into Western Alaska here in the recent past, and trying to bolster our support of rural Alaska, being that we are a rural law enforcement entity. The online reporting program, that's something that we've been trying to bring on for a number of years. We finally realized the implementation of it, and we feel that once it's fully up to speed, if you will, it could pull a significant amount of workload off the backs of troopers on the road, allowing them to focus more on the investigations that they're responding to, while still giving your constituents the service that they need through the online reporting process. Some of the challenges, probably not huge surprises, but recruitment and retention. We suffer from the same challenges seen in law enforcement nationwide. There's not a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, if you will, in terms of applicants to become Alaska State Troopers. It is a significantly demanding job in law enforcement, certainly within the job set of the Alaska State Troopers. But our recruitment efforts are robust. I think over the last year, we've hired or sent 51 troopers to training down at the academy. So we can continue to, as we say, work at full power on our recruitment and the retention of our people. We have a bit of a challenge when it comes to retaining people, and we work tirelessly on many fronts to become that competitive employer where people want to stay and work for long periods of time. Technological changes in how crimes are committed, that's a, I think throughout time, that's a constant effort to stay ahead of the criminals out there, if you will, committing crimes. They become continuously innovative in the way that they work and using digital media to do so. Importation of drugs and alcohol into rural Alaska, I don't think that that's a secret. Our entire nation suffers from the problems associated with illicit drug use and the drug trade. We are doing everything that we can to bolster our efforts in that regard to catch the illicit drugs and the folks that are peddling them before they reach our rural communities and devastate them, obviously in the ways that we're familiar with and the second and third orders of effect that that has generationally. Rural housing, huge challenge for state troopers in trying to attract people to bid to and stay in rural parts of Alaska. So finding good, clean, safe, affordable, relatively affordable housing is a constant challenge and that we're constantly addressing. Next slide, please.
And actually, Deputy yes. Commissioner, I think Representative Armstrong and Representative Story have a question for you.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm curious what percentage or what number are on the two-on-two-off schedule, and if you're able to share how many of those are based in Alaska or are based out of state when they're on that two-off.
Understand. Thank you, Rep. Johnson. And through the chair, I don't have the exact number in my head right now as far as how many two-and-two positions we have. I think at literal positions, it's in the 20 range. All with the exception of one right now live within the state of Alaska. There were a couple of people that were grandfathered into, if you will, a prior practice with that. One has recently retired, relatively recently retired. We have one trooper living out of state right now. Our practice moving forward into the future would be that all state troopers are living within the state of Alaska and ready and able to respond when needed.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Certainly.
Yep, Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. And through the chair, I see that one of the challenges is rural housing. And I know we will be looking at budgets, and I am wondering if you could give me an idea of how much housing is in your current budget for rural housing for troopers, and if that is something that needs to be addressed.
Either way, I can take a stab at this, if you will. So I'd have to get you the exact number in terms of the money that we're spending on rural housing. Certainly we can provide that. We have a number of units that we lease and own, a combination of leased and owned properties throughout the state of Alaska. I think in the neighborhood of 60 units, if you will, to house troopers and other staff. And it's quite an endeavor. Obviously, there's a fair amount of money in those leases and the maintenance of owned properties in rural Alaska, but we can get you those exact numbers.
Thank you.
Yes, sure.
To the chair, if I can help answer the question too. We did ask for money from Lisa Murkowski last year, earmarked, they call it something else, but we did get $3 million from the senator to utilize for rural housing in Alaska. We're not sure how far that will go, but it's a step in the right direction. If we want to continue to send troopers to the rural areas of the state, which we must as a state, we must support those regions. We have to have decent housing, have to have office space and connectivity, which we're currently working on. I mean, we've underserved that area for so long. It's time for us to step up.
Thank you, Representative Story. Thank you, Commissioner Cockrell. We'll try to speed through these slides. I know there's a handful of them. If we could just sort of contain questions till the end, that would be helpful. Thank you. Commissioner Barlow.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. So moving on to the Division of Alaska Wildlife Troopers, that division has a northern and southern detachment within our department. They are focused on the protection of wildlife resources in Alaska, both sport hunting and fishing, as well as commercial fishing, obviously a huge industry in Alaska, and commercially guided hunting. Continue to collaborate with federal agencies and other state agencies, providing boater safety and hunter safety education in an effort to reduce hunting injuries and boater fatalities. There's a huge area of responsibility out there, many thousands of miles of coastline, and complicated regulatory systems to navigate in the course of those enforcement efforts. Next slide, please. Commissioner?
No. So we asked about vacancies. This is probably the easiest chart to show. We show that we got a full zero vacancies in the VPSO job class. I already mentioned we've got 50 vacancies in the trooper job class. That includes 8 wildlife troopers and 42 Alaska State Troopers AST division. We're budgeted totally with all trooper positions at 410, and we currently have 360.
Thanks. That was for that was Commissioner Cockrell, and Senator Klayman does have a brief question about this slide.
Yeah, thanks. Through the chair, I've heard from the Anchorage Police and Fire that they have kind of this gap from about 5 years of experience, and then there's like a not a lot of people with 10 and 15 and 20 years, and then you get some much more senior folks. In your numbers, are you seeing a similar trend? I think we've heard the same from prosecutors and public defenders as well. Is that something you're seeing in troopers as well, that you kind of get people for 5 years and then they leave?
Through the chair, I think that's actually going in a different direction. But I will say that our senior staff, our lieutenants and above, are all pretty much every one of them is eligible for retirement right now. And I can get you those numbers. I will say there was a drain of people leaving the department right at 5 years. And that was before the troopers got their pay raises and we were more competitive to the outside market. I don't know that we're actually seeing a huge loss of troopers right at 5 years. So I think we're fairly balanced as a department, except on the further down end, you know, the closer to retirement.
Follow up? Yep, Representative Senator Quinn.
When, this is my memory is failing, when did the pay increase come that really started impacting your ability to retain people past the five-year mark?
Through the chair, that came in right as the governor came in, and it was 2019 is when they got their pay increases. Great.
Thank you. Senator Clayton. Thank you, Commissioner. I think Deputy Commissioner Barlow. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Again, for the record, Deputy Commissioner Brian Barlow. This slide here depicts our aircraft section and marine section. An agency like ourselves working in inland waterways and open ocean and largely roadless areas depends on a number of unconventional conveyances to get to our calls for service. So a number of vessels within our fleet, you can see here, all the way from a 156-foot converted crabbing boat down to numerous riverborne and small skiffs. Our aircraft section, currently 44 total combined fixed-wing and rotor-wing aircraft that we use statewide, literally to use like patrol cars to get to our calls for service in the different rural communities that we serve. They're used by the Alaska State Troopers for law enforcement response, for the wildlife troopers, for resource protection, search and rescue operations, prisoner transport, and just a multitude of department of business. We also support other state departments with our aircraft fleet as well.
The VPSO program, I think we've pretty much touched on this. I will say that, again, the VPSO program right now under the current structure is running as smooth as I've ever seen it run. We have it in our budget asked to actually fund a full-time director into that because Colonel Hard right now is a long-term non-perm essentially running the VPSO program, and we see that as the model forward instead of the way that we've done it in the past.
For the record, Deputy Commissioner Barlow here, the Division of Fire and Light Safety within the DPS mission to prevent loss of life and property from fire and explosion, like the slide says, through enforcement of state statutes, engineering, and education. Some of the major accomplishments in the last year, obviously, over 650 building and fire safety inspections, nearly 800 fire and building plan reviews completed, 45 significant fire investigations, which are very complicated investigations, very forensic in nature, if you will, those types of arson investigations, and many times involved the death of persons as well. We did recently implement a new web-based application to process permits near the end of calendar 2022, processed 170 applications over the course of about 2 to 4 weeks. We realized some significant improvements in the processing of plan review within the Division of Fire and Life Safety. Again, challenges, we continue to struggle with rural fire capacity in terms of equipment and training and personnel, something that we will work with communities to improve throughout the future, and then communication methods to reach high-risk groups in rural areas regarding personal responsibility to decrease loss of property and life. Next slide, please. Division of Statewide Services, a pretty major division within the DPS. New in the last years, the Alaska Public Safety Communication Services supports the ALMR, the Alaska Land Mobile Radio System. As you can see here, with just millions, literally millions of calls and push-to-talks over the course of the year. Major accomplishment in the updated repeater sites, 72 different repeater sites throughout the state. Information systems basically accomplished the linking of 30 years of historical case files or written or handwritten reports, if you will, into our records management system within DPS, and deployed the new online police reporting system that I spoke about earlier. Our Criminal Justice Information Systems program secured a number of federal grants to support the upgrade or the modernization of our Criminal Justice Information Services, which covers a multitude of database services, if you will, within our department, in an effort to move away from a really aged mainframe system that was designed and implemented in the mid-80s. So that's a huge effort underway right now. The Crime Lab, or the Alaska Scientific Crime Detection Lab, more commonly known as the Lab, over 9,000 DNA samples collected from arrestees, convicted offenders over the last year, so we're making a lot of headway in that regard, and nearly 2,500 sexual assault kits. Testing is completed in nearly 2,500 kits over the last year. A highlight of that is a reduction of the backlog of nearly 57%. Next slide, also related to the Crime Lab, just kind of depicts.
Take one really quick break. Yes. For Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair.
Through the chair, I just have one quick question. Just wanted to understand the status of the ALMR. Are you happy with the move? I know it just recently moved there. Is it a good fit?
Representative Wright, through the chair, we believe it's a good fit. We're a major user of the ALMR system. It's integrating well into our department, and we believe we're making positive headway with it. Yes.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Yep. Senator Klayman has a question.
Actual backlog on texting the sex assault kits.
The actual backlog?
Yeah, you've closed it a bunch, but what's left to do?
Right. I'd have to get you, if you're looking for an exact number, I can get you an exact number as of today, but I don't have that with me today. You're talking in quantity, sir? Thank you, sir. Through the chair, I don't have that number with me today, but I can find it for you. And I'd hate to guess.
Okay, that'll be fine. And okay. If you could just send it through to the chair's offices, we'll make sure that all the members get it.
Certainly, I can say, thank you, Chair Kawasaki. I can say that obviously there's been dramatic decrease in the backlog and thus positive, lots of positive headway made in the processing of those kits.
Through the chair, can I answer the question?
Oh, yeah, please. Commissioner.
To my knowledge, we have zero backlog on sexual assault kits from our Saki grant program. And we're processing current sex cases in around 55 days. We currently now have an app so a victim of a sexual assault can follow their tracking system throughout the whole process. We're going live with that here. We either have or we're getting really close to doing that. I mean, we've made substantial gains on how we handle sexual assault kits. A sexual assault kit that is, say, done in Fairbanks, Bethel, Nome, Kotzebue has to be at our crime lab within 30 days. And that kit does not leave our crime lab after that time period. We keep all sexual assault kits now at the crime lab. So we went light years ahead of where we were just 2 years ago.
And Senator Klayman for a follow-up.
So we closed the backlog, and the other part is, and I'm having a memory gap, but I think in the legislation we passed last year, we put a timeline on when you're supposed to test current kits or new kits, as it were. And is that a 90-day timeline that you're supposed to finish the testing? I'm seeing heads nodding.
Through the chair, we're required to have the results done within 90 days. And right now we're at 55 days by average.
Just one quick follow-up.
And Senator Klayman?
So we're basically today we are current and complying with the law in terms of the speed with which you're testing.
Through the chair, that's correct. And I would say a lot of that is because of the efforts that you and other legislators have made in funding the positions needed to make that happen. I appreciate that.
Great. Any other questions? Okay, we can continue.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. Moving on to slide 14, Commissioner Cockrell.
All right. I'll go through this really quick. You guys can see the uniform crime reporting. What I would like to say on this is that our sexual assaults are still climbing up very slowly, but they're climbing up. It's essentially last year we had approximately 1,500 reported felony level sexual assaults in the state. And usually, you know, rule of thumb, about 50% of crime doesn't get reported. Out of that, 304 were in our Western Alaska area. And of that, a total of 338 in Western Alaska, 304 of our victims were Alaska Native women. Alaska Native women, statewide, are sexually assaulted at a higher rate than any other race in our state, and they have a smaller percentage of our population. I don't know if there's questions on that one. And that could be we could go into a deep dive about our sexual assault and domestic violence rates here in our state. The Council of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, the most dedicated staff that I think I have, they're totally focused on trying to reduce the incidence of domestic violence, sexual assault. They've, for advocate services, they've updated and now they've got, in different languages, you can go online, and if you speak Hmong, or I got all of them. Anyway, the most eight spoke languages in the state, they've got, you can go in there and get, that way you can get services for if you're a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault. I didn't say that very well, but, and their biggest, you know, they've had outreach to all our 329 federally recognized tribes. They had reached out that they've updated their regulations, and their biggest, I would say their biggest hurdle is consistent funding for the council. We rely a lot on federal funding, BOCA and VAWA money, and that's based on federal receipts of either civil or criminal fines, and that is not consistent, and it's continually fallen. So the state has had to make up that, that difference, and we would certainly count on the legislature to make sure that we're kept whole, because they're doing a very important job in a state that needs that type of training and outreach. The last one, we all, last year, just over a year ago, we took over the Violent Crime Compensation Board from the Department of Administration. When we took it over, we had over 1,000 cases that were pending. We have a staff of three, and we're asking for two additional staff members, because in 1973 we had three and we had 15 applications. Now we're averaging over 1,000 applications. We desperately need to be able to process these claims that we're getting and provide financial support to victims of violent crimes. And so we are asking for two positions. The only concern I have about that is the fact that we're pulling the funding for those two positions out of the violent crimes board funding that is, comes from permanent fund from prisoners that have to donate their permanent fund to the state. And so that means that's less funding for our victims. That's my big concern. And I think that will wrap it up. Oh, you got one more.
For the record, Deputy Commissioner Barlow, the last slide we really have here is dedicated to the Alaska Police Standards Council, which is in place to help promote and maintain the professional certification of police officers statewide. Any questions for us?
Okay. We'll take general questions of the Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner. We also have Lisa Perrington, the Chief of Criminal Records and Identification Bureau, who's here. We have a handful of folks who are online, including the director of VPSOs, the VPSO program, the executive director from the Police Standards Council, the director of statewide services, director of the state troopers, Ms. Shankin from the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, as well as Mary Beth Gagnon from the Center Council of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assaults, who's in the room. So if there are any questions that could be directed at any of those folks, we can bring them up on the record. We have Representative Armstrong and then Representative Wright.
Thank you, through the chair. Would you be able to share with us the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, your budget and the funding that you're seeking?
Through the chair, I would lifeline that to Mary Beth.
Okay. Is Mary Beth in the room? Maybe. She's online. Oh, she's probably calling in online.
That's, we can follow up too after if you can just share.
I think we have her right now.
Good afternoon. This is Mary Beth Gagnon for the record from the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
I can repeat my question. I was curious what funding you were seeking, what your budget looks like, and just to see where the state might be able to help support.
Through the chair, I would need to pull up.
Oh, thank you.
Our actual budget that we were discussing this morning, but we are seeking approximately, I believe it was $3 million to assist in compensating for victim service shelter program, perpetrator rehabilitation, and suspension programming.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have Representative Story and then Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. And through the chair, I'm not sure if the commissioner should answer this, and I was trying to follow it, but I know last year the legislature added 7 positions and funding to address domestic violence, sexual assault, and the missing, murdered, and Indigenous persons loss. And I was following that. We've added 4 for the missing, murdered, Indigenous people investigations. But were those positions filled? And can you provide us a little bit of an update on how the work is going? Because obviously what you just shared was very concerning.
Through the chair, I'll try to answer your question because it's more than one question there. Essentially, under the governor's initiative, the investigators are not attached to the MMIP initiative from the governor. Those are something I added based on the needs of the department. We added 2 tribal liaisons. We have one of those filled that's embedded into the BPSO program. We're recruiting for the second one. We added 4 victim witness coordinators plus a witness supervisor. So there was 5 of the positions. Those we've hired the manager. We're now in the process of actually recruiting for the victim witness coordinators. And that was to keep our victims engaged in our criminal justice system, especially with our troopers. And it was, again, it was focused on trying to get victims the support they need for they would stay within the system. We would have a higher rate of prosecution of those because they would stay engaged. We would know where they were at. Plus, as a department, that's one of the things, and I've said this before, our victims get lost in the criminal justice system. That are the first ones to get lost. And if we don't communicate with them, if we don't engage with them, we lose them, especially in our villages. And then the cases go untried and that offender goes free. And so it was our attempt to engage our victims where we have more and stronger prosecution. Plus, I think it helps our victims that we care as a society, as a department.
Follow up.
Yep, follow up.
Thank you for that. And so I'm assuming those positions are continuing. And then on page 12, you talked about the numerous calls that have been supported and taken. Is there any way to break that down by region so we can see where is that coming differently from one area than the other, highlighting a particular need that might be missed?
Through the chair, we could look at that. And now these aren't telephone calls. These are radio communications back and forth between either our dispatch or our troopers to our dispatch. So these are all radio calls. We can look at that and see what kind of data that we have, because I don't know.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative Story. Representative Wright.
Through the chair, thank you. Is there any concern regarding the transition of calibers from 40 to 9 mil? I know that the 9 mil travels about 1,320 feet per second, and the 40 mil is a bit slower. You're concerned with it like going through walls and going through people and hitting other people or anything of that nature?
Through the chair, first of all, we'd be concerned regardless of what firearm we use. But based on the ammunition that we are currently using, we feel that it's similar or has the same stopping power as the 40. But the ammunition is cheaper, easier for us to come by. And there's other reasons we went with the 9mm and upgraded our firearm system, including our sighting system.
Follow up.
Yep, person right.
I think it's great. I'm a 9mm guy myself, but, you know.
And we can talk about this offline. Sure. So. Perfect.
Thank you. Are there further questions for the commissioner? Senator Klayman.
So you and I have talked a lot about the unchanging statistics of sexual assault and sexual abuse, particularly in rural Alaska. What's the plan for this year in terms of increasing services in rural Alaska that may make a difference in, you know?
Well, first of all, dealing with sexual assault and domestic violence, you know, it's an interpersonal crime usually occurring in a residence. So the general thought right away is add more cops to the area, more police officers, more troopers. And that doesn't necessarily going to stop what's going on. in our communities. And first of all, we don't have the ability right now to put more troopers in rural areas because of our logistical issues, even though that's a priority of this department and will continue to be a priority as long as I'm the commissioner. Because, well, like I've said, we've done those communities a disservice or an injustice for since statehood. And unless we as a state say we're not going to do it anymore, we're going to pony up, we're going to make it right, things aren't going to change. We're going to continue to prosecute people, and we're going to continue to investigate sexual assaults. Unless there's a societal change in areas of the state that says that's not okay, we're just going to continue to do what we're doing, and we're going to put young Alaska Natives in prison.
Senator Klayman.
Is there a plan to increase VPSO numbers in this year's budget? If you're not able to put more troopers in some of the rural villages, what about VPSOs?
The VPSO program, as we said, is important to our department, especially in rural Alaska, and they're not only because we focus on law enforcement, but they do many other things. I just want to put that on the record. Currently, we don't have a budget asked for additional troop or VPSO. We're hoping, I think there was an oversight during the budget process, and because our intentions was to add 10 VPSOs and continue to do that. My ultimate goal is to get 120. And we got to fix that.
Senator Klayman.
So if in the budget process we added 10 VPSOs to the budget, that would be something the department would welcome?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Senator Klayman. Are there further questions of the commissioner or folks who may be online? Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again, Commissioner Cockle, for joining us. Trooper response time is really important to folks on the Kenai Peninsula as well as others around the state. Could you tell us a little bit, please, about what the department is doing to reduce trooper response time on the Kenai Peninsula, please?
Well, through the chair, I think we've talked about this before. Realistically, to get better trooper response time anywhere in urban Alaska, we're responding with our patrol vehicles. It means adding more troopers. There's no, we're maxed out. We provide what I consider less than adequate coverage in urban Alaska and rural Alaska. I mean, when you look at it, I joined the department in 1983. We had more troopers in 1983 than we do now, 2023. And our population has increased by over 200,000 people. And our crimes have gotten more complex, for sure. I know that our crime numbers have went down, but if you look at our violent crimes, we lead the nation per capita in violent crime. I mean, we've reduced our crime rate by 15%, which is just a snapshot. But our violent crime is still one of the highest in the nation by population. When you look at our racial police officers to citizens, we're not even close to the International Chiefs of Police standards. I mean, we're below that, especially in the Mat-Su Valley. I mean, we got right about 50 patrol troopers assigned to the Mat-Su Valley, a population of 110,000. If you add Talkeetna, which we have to go to, we're up to 119,000 for in a size of West Virginia, Arkansas. It depends on what state you like best. But that'd be like going to West Virginia and having four deputy sheriffs patrolling the whole West Virginia. I mean, this is ridiculous. We're sending troopers to domestic violence by themselves. Bad things happen. Either we end up hurting the person that we're trying to do it, or our trooper gets assaulted and gets hurt. I mean, this is ridiculous, really, when you think about it.
Thank you. I think there's a follow-up question.
Thank you, Mr.
Bjorkman.
So, Commissioner, as we talk about Mat-Su being of a certain size and the Kenai Peninsula being a very similar size, how is trooper coverage similar or different of those two areas with similar size?
Well, first of all, they're not similar in size because we got less troopers on the peninsula than we do in the Mat-Su Valley. The population's less. I think the distances that we travel are less on the Kenai Peninsula than we are in parts of the Mat-Su Valley where we're going from Palmer all the way out to Talkeetna for Call or Willow. So there are similarities to crimes because we because I live on the peninsula, but we have crimes that are committed from people that don't live in the Kenai Peninsula, like Anchorage. The Matsu Valley has that 10 times what the Kenai does. A lot of our serious crimes in the Matsu Valley are committed by Anchorage residents. And the reason, part of the reason I think it is because Anchorage has stepped up their patrols, stepped up their number of officers, so it's a lot easier to come to the valley and rape and pillage than it is in Anchorage, and that's what we're seeing. I mean, if you look at our crime stats in the Matsu Valley, it's staggering. Our troopers are getting run ragged. And I could say the same thing about the Kenai Peninsula, because at any time on the swing shift or nights, you might have two troopers on that's patrolling from Anchor Point, if we don't call out the Anchor Point trooper, all the way out past Cooper Landing or out in your neck of the woods. I mean, and even at pursuit speeds, it's going to take us a while to get there if we're not tied up on something else.
Thank you, Commissioner, for the candid dialogue we've had today. We do have a couple more questions. Briefly, we have Representative Story, Representative Wright, and then Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. Through the chair, obviously, when we talk about crime, so much of what's underneath it, and you just expressed it a little bit, is behavioral health and addiction treatment. And how do you see the support coming from that we can help? We know if we really want to get a handle on reducing domestic violence, we have to deal with those issues. And I'm not sure how much in your budgets that it allows for behavioral health and addiction treatment.
To the chair, Representative Story, I would say that's really not our preview of funding mental health. That's Health and Social Services or the Health Department. I mean, we can only focus on what we can focus on, and we're a law enforcement agency. Even though I agree with you, we need more mental health services in this state. We're, as a department, as you know, and sometimes raised, we're not perfect. We try to be perfect as a law enforcement agency, but we do make mistakes. I will say again that, because I testify in behalf of the mental health crisis model, I think that's very important. And talking to Steve Williams with mental health, that they're trying to expand that. We're seeing a lot more mental health issues in our state, and I think that's country nationwide. I'm not sure what the reasons are, not that type of, but we're certainly seeing it impacts our troopers, and then of course addiction affects, you know, all aspects of our society. When we lose 120 Alaskans a year on average, there's something wrong there. When we see as much fentanyl and heroin that we're seizing right now routinely, that means there's a lot of drugs. And this, I think the scary part about it is, much we've set records this year in the amount of drugs we seize, but the street value of the drugs on the street haven't went up. Usually if we're seizing and making a real big difference in our seizures, the drugs will, prices will continue to climb, and we haven't seen that right now. So I don't think I answered your question, but
you did.
So, all right, thank you.
Thank you for that answer. We have two more quick questions, Senator Wilikowski and then Representative Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned about Anchorage and Matsu, and in Anchorage, as you know, we have a tax base, and we have pay a fairly large portion of our property tax bill that goes to provide police. And are there communities in Alaska that do have a tax base, that are organized boroughs, that are not providing a police forces, but are instead relying on the state to provide that in the form of troopers?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I think you know that answer as much as I do. We have areas of the state that have a tax base that we're currently providing services for.
What are those areas, Mr. Chairman?
I'm sorry?
What are those areas?
Well, I would say specifically if it is Matsu Valley, the Kenai Peninsula, and the Fairbanks North Suburb. And there's others. I mean, certainly we have the Ketchikan. They have a fully functioning police department, and we provide services outside their jurisdiction.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you for the question. Representative Carpenter has the last word. No, maybe not the last word, but.
Oh, darn it. All right. Real quick question. Sir, you referenced a organization that was standards
earlier. Can you repeat that for me?
Through the chair, yes. International Chiefs of Police.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. We may have some follow-up questions for you, Commissioner. So we'll forward questions. If there's any questions that folks have that weren't answered today or need clarification, they can come through one of our offices. We'll make sure that you get them, Commissioner. We appreciate your time. We appreciate you also coming out of retirement to serve as commissioner. And thank you very much for your service. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. And thank you to all the folks who are online and in the room on behalf of the department.
Thank you, sir.
We'll take a brief at ease for the commissioner designee corrections to come up. Welcome back to the Joint State Affairs Committees. Next, we have a presentation from the Department of Corrections, Commissioner Designee Winkleman, and I just want to say for the record that we will subject the Commissioner Designee to a further grilling at a later meeting, as she will go through confirmations before both the House and Senate State Affairs Committees. So this is just a brief overview or an generalized overview of the department and its operations. We also have Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson and a whole host of other folks who are online or in the room to help. So with that, welcome, Commissioner Designee Winkleman.
Excellent. Thank you, and thanks for the invitation this afternoon. For the record, I am Jen Winkleman. I am the Commissioner Designee for the Department of Corrections, and with me, like the chair mentioned, I have Deputy Commissioner April Wilkerson, and I do have all the directors for all the different divisions we'll touch on today online or in the room. So if there are specifics, I will phone a friend for them and hopefully get you answers that you need. Starting on the first slide, one thing I will start by mentioning is the Department of Corrections actually used to be housed under the department as a division under the Department of Health and Social Services. It separated under an executive order in 1984. I used to think we were a young department, and then I realized that's 40 years ago. So we became our own department in 1984 under that executive order. Our mission is to provide secure confinement, reformative programs, and a process of supervised community reintegration to enhance the safety of communities. We have four divisions that meet those core services of secure confinement, programming, and release. And you can see on the diagram on the slide what division hits which part of our mission. We have a little over 2,100 permanent full-time employees with our department, and our budget is about $419 million. So Alaska is one of seven states that operates a unified correctional system, and the best way I can describe that is that the jails and the prisons are under one umbrella. So in many areas where things are non-unified, you will see jails being run by sheriff's offices, sometimes even the courts. And so we have a unified system, and it brings its own sense of challenges, if you will, by having the jails and prisons together to triage for programming and services, and we'll be getting into that a little bit later. In FY22, the department booked over 27,000 individuals. You'll note on this slide that nearly 17,000 were unique offenders. What that means is that multiples were booked into our facility multiple times. So we actually, our chief research analyst recently shared that he came across a person that had been booked into a facility 94 times in a 3-year time frame, and that was equal to the person being booked once every 10 days, and these were on criminal charges. As of January of the beginning of this year, the department was responsible for nearly 11,000 individuals. That includes folks that are, we have the 4,400 as noted on the slide for those that are in custody. Then we have the others that are out in the community in some fashion. So whether they're on pretrial supervision, out on probation or parole, or they are on sentenced electronic monitoring or at our halfway houses. This slide shows an overview of the structure of the department. One thing that I will note is that the parole board is housed budgetarily within the Department of Corrections. It is fully autonomous. The staff in the unit point directly to the parole board, and the parole board is made up of 5 members. 3 are members by their judicial district, 2 are at large. They are appointed by the governor and then confirmed by the legislature. I will also note, just with our organizational chart off to the side there, we were earlier today kind of looking at our experience, and we have over 150 years of Alaska DOC experience on that chart. So I'd like to think that we're subject matter experts. The next slide, the Division of Institutions. This division provides the secure confinement that starts or begins the process of rehabilitation and supervised release. You will note all of the bullets under this slide are housed under our Division of Institutions, and I'll just point out a couple of them. You'll see inmate grievance resolution. What that is we have a grievance and standards position within the Division of Institutions that handles things at a lower level before it reaches a point to coming up to a lawsuit, essentially. The delegation for any prisoner transport comes from DPS for us to be able to transport offenders for medical or for population management. And so you'll also see that we handle medical transports or housing transports when we're moving them inmates in between facilities. We have a classification and furlough unit. Every individual that is in our custody is classified. So essentially a risk assessment for all offenders, and at that point it's determined where folks are going to be housed, maybe if they are have a status of separatee where they can't be placed around somebody. The classification unit handles all of those, all of the kind of the oversight system-wide. Furlough is the other end of the system. It's when folks are getting ready to be released, and this unit will process folks on the other side of getting released from custody. The next slide shows a visual of our institutional capacity and jail locations at the start of this year. The yellow represents the general capacity, and our general capacity is all of our beds in general population without thinking of our segregation beds. The maximum capacity is all of the general beds plus half of the segregation beds. You will note by this slide, and it is no mistake, that we have worked really hard to keep all facilities below their general capacity. This will contribute to the employee wellness, the safety within facilities, and it is something we've just been working on really, really hard. I know that there was a question prior to this meeting about whether or not the capacity was constrained by vacancy factors that we have. So we have a staffing profile that we must meet. And so in order to meet those, we will transfer staff, or staff will be, will, if we have a vacancy in Spring Creek down in Seward, if we have staff in Wildwood, they'll go down and cover for those shifts. So the capacity is not constrained by our vacancy factors. So we have seen that our unsentenced population has continued to grow, and that is something, it's for a myriad of reasons, and we saw it before COVID growing, we saw it during COVID growing, and there was, during COVID, it started to grow because of court hearings. What we're also seeing a little bit anecdotally is that, and it goes to what Commissioner Cockrell had talked about, is folks are coming in on more serious charges. And so those take longer to dispose of as well. So they're a little more complex cases, and they will just, they'll sit in an unsentenced status for a longer period of time. I will make a note that on this slide, it does not include the nearly 200 unsentenced federal holds that we have. So we do hold unsentenced federal inmates also, and we have approximately 200, 197 from this slide. So this slide reflects the same population from the prior slide and then shows the crimes that the person was being held for. You'll note on here that our crimes against a person take up a bulk of the slide. While our sex offenses are considered a crime against a person, we broke those out just because of particular interest in seeing what our population makeup is of our sex offenders in custody. You'll note on there the non-registrable sex offenses. Some of those are the indecent exposure, some of the prostitution charges that don't require registration for a sex offense, but you'll see that they do have a little piece of the pie chart there. Alcohol, I will note that the vehicle offense class that shows on this slide, it is of the driving with a suspended license or something of the of that nature, where alcohol is where the DUI charges will fall under.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. Thank you, Ms. Winkleman, for being here. How many people would fall into more than one category on this chart?
So through the chair to Senator Merrick, that's a fantastic question. We will have to get you the answer on that. I would bet that there are many.
Fantastic. And follow-up?
Senator Merrick.
And if this chart is not put together in that way, how is it determined which category someone falls into?
Through the chair to Senator Merrick, it is going to be the most serious crime, and so we will get the follow-up on the other end.
Great. Thanks so much. Thank you, Chair.
Go ahead and continue.
Okay. So this slide breaks out the Division of Health and Rehabilitation Services. So this, we in the Department of Corrections love to use acronyms, and so we call this division HARS, and it will handle the medical and mental health component of the division, as well as treatment, programming, and education. And so you will note on here that with the physical health care and the behavioral health care, I will share that the Department of Corrections has a constitutional and a statutory obligation to provide health care to offenders who are placed into our custody. So the Division of Health and Rehabilitation Services is responsible for providing timely access to essential health care. And we utilize the guidance and the standards from the National Commission on Correctional Healthcare for best practice, and then we also utilize our own experience and training for this. Every inmate that comes through the door is given a thorough screening, both in an interview as well as a physical. We will even try to obtain medical records from outside and other agencies with them. The other areas, as far as the treatment goes, we handle sex offender treatment through this division. It is handled both in the facility and out when folks are on probation or parole. The contracts for treatment providers will be there. We have educational vocational programming. The oversight is through the Division of Health and Rehabilitation Services. And then I would just note that a full listing of detailed programs is on the internet under this division's website, if you are interested in specifics on what is offered in the facility in your area. So the Division of Pretrial Probation and Parole, again, back to the acronyms, you'll hear sometimes referred to as DP3. In 2018, the department stood up the Pretrial Enforcement Division. It was actually before that. In 2018, with the change of administration, we blended both the Division of Probation and Parole and Pretrial Enforcement Division for an efficiency for the department. These handle all community correction services out in the field. We will see that both are guided by risk assessments as far as supervision of the caseloads. And we saw quite a substantial growth of the utilization of pretrial services while COVID was in the thick of COVID. And what we saw was the courts utilizing electronic monitoring for our pretrial defendants. So we saw a substantial spike in our electronic monitoring of our pretrial defendants during this time, and we've sort of seen it just maintain. So it's been a great tool for the courts to be able to use for folks, and that is housed under this division. We also have a victim service unit for the entire department that is tucked into the Division of Pretrial Probation and Parole. It does handle contact with victims for those that may never touch probation and parole or pretrial. So if somebody is being released from a facility, they can register on our system, on our victim information network system. It's called VINE. And the system will automatically call a victim, let them know if somebody's getting out of custody or if there's been a movement between facilities or out to a halfway house. Like I mentioned previously, the Board of Parole is housed budgetarily within DOC. Two primary functions of the Parole Board are to process parole applications and hold hearings to approve or deny parole. And then on the tail end is to also process violations. So they will handle violations when somebody who is out on parole commits a violation. The parole board and their staff work with our institutional probation officers and our field probation officers or parole officers throughout the state. So we all work well together in determining release plans for individuals. Division of Administrative Services oversees, our Division of Administrative Services oversees more than just the budget and procurement and the money part of a department. Essentially, our Division of Admin Services oversees various statewide functions. You will note on this that we have our IT section. We have an inmate law library that must be operational, and of course, we have our offender management system. We refer to as ACOMS, Alaska Correctional Offender Management System. And the IT section under this division handles both of those. We have research and records, as you saw from our slides and some of our great data that we're able to pull up. We have a chief research analyst and his team who work at giving us the information where we can look and see trends and things like that. So they are housed under our Division of Administrative Services as well. And, of course, facilities. And I just would note that we have aging facilities that withstand the earthquakes and the windstorms. And we have a great facilities group that is housed under the Division of Admin Services as well. Office of the Commissioner. These are items that touch all areas of the department, so all of the areas, including Admin Services. And I would turn your attention to our training academy that handles all of our officer training. It handles all of our staff training. We work well with other agencies such as DPS and municipal officers, in whether it's their folks coming in for training or we're able to cross-train with some of their staff as well. We also have things, our policy and procedure is handled under the commissioner's office, as well as our public information officer. And then, of course, recruitment and retention. Because recruitment and retention touches our entire department, they fall under the commissioner's office as well. So, like DPS mentioned, DOC is also faced with the same nationwide workforce issues. And if you add the intricacies of a correctional system and some of the social unrest, then it brings with itself its own set of unique challenges. I am proud to say that our overall statewide vacancy rate is at 13% right now. But I will say that we have some areas that have significantly higher vacancy rates. And I'll speak specifically to our Spring Creek and down in Seward right now has, I believe, a little more than 35% vacancy rates. So we've got a couple of facilities and areas that are doing really well that bring that overall vacancy rate down. However, it's not lost on us that we're faced with some of those same challenges. And this is across the board, and we still have to feed inmates, we still have to provide medical for inmates, and so what comes with that then is a lot of contracting out to get folks in, and that comes at a higher price tag. We have been working really hard to get positions filled. I'd like to think that we have made some great headway, and some of this, yeah, the members here may have heard. You know, we've done some things with recruitment as far as higher incentives. We've done a TDY program, a transfer temporary duty station assignment down to the Spring Creek where we provide housing and some. So we've also been able to do some expanded housing for those that are looking. We've worked with the Department of Administration to expand housing search options for some of the harder to fill areas so that folks can have temporary housing, even if it's something like a hotel, while they're looking for housing in some of these harder to fill areas. So certainly working hard on trying to figure out ways to recruit. But I say very strongly that if we don't, if we work on retention, then the recruitment takes care of itself. And so trying to look at ways to work on the retention end of things, I will note we have attendance incentives. We've worked on some preferred shift assignments and schedules. We're in the process right now of trying to build out a traveling unit so that we can have a kind of a pool of officers that can cover in different areas. So certainly have the absolute same challenges as everyone else with regard to recruitment. Like to think we're making some headway. Certainly facing some of the same. We have been looking ahead, obviously, workplace profile to know when we lose a lot of folks in April and May due to retirements. And we have a couple facilities that we think about it across the board, but a couple of facilities where we have been fortunate enough to fill some positions in preparation for those retirements. So it's a work in progress all the time, but certainly something we're working on.
Commissioner, we have a question from Representative Wright.
Through the chair, the traveling unit, what exactly would it be doing? Is it filling in for people who can't come to work or something of that nature?
So through the chair to Representative Wright, yes. And we're in the very initial stages, but the idea is in some of the more urban areas where it's easier to fill, where people can have housing, then we will be looking at kind of building a unit that could go out and cover for vacancies in other areas.
Okay, and follow up. Will there be like a time limit on it, like folks being away, you know, traveling? Will it be like months at a time, or is it just for a week, or?
Through the chair to Representative Wright, it would depend. A typical shift of a correctional officer, and while there's many different, we've allowed folks to be on straight days and straight nights, but is a week on, week off. And I say typical very, very tongue-in-cheek, because with all the overtime right now and all the vacancies, the week off is spent with a lot of folks working those extra shifts. That being said, the idea would be that we'd be able to fill shifts for periods of time to go cover these. But it's, like I said, still somewhat in the beginning phases, I think those are the type of things that we would have to figure out from staff what the preferences and such would be, and work with the union as well, because there's some bargaining agreement rules around this.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. You have one more slide, I think. Oh, Representative Story, do you have a question?
Thank you. Through the chair, I was thinking about our core services and providing physical health care for citizens who are incarcerated, and we've all been so concerned about the loss of life that we have had. And when you talk about not having adequate staffing, I would really like to hear more about physical care of citizens when they come into custody and how that is assessed, and if there's any gaps that are needed to fill for funding.
So through the chair to Representative Story, to answer the first question with regard to staffing, we certainly utilize contract and Logan services to be able to get medical staff to be able to provide the services, so that that piece is, there's always will be somebody to come out to booking to meet somebody that comes in through our facility. With regard to the healthcare, I would like to call Director Adam Rutherford up to the table, and maybe he could answer some more specific question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, welcome to the committee, Director. If you can, put your name, affiliation, and title on the record. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Adam Rutherford. I'm the acting director of HARS. And through the chair, we start really our medical services right from the get-go on intake. And that starts with an in-depth assessment, interviews, looking at medical records releases, those pieces. We use standardized screening forms. But a lot of that does depend on intake on what the individuals share with us. Once we have that information, we have referrals to mental health. We have referrals to substance abuse treatment. We also have referrals to our providers in-house for any type of follow-up medical needs. And throughout the time that folks are incarcerated, we've done training for our officers to recognize medical needs, medical symptoms. We also do rounds in our facilities by our nursing staff. We also have an option for offenders to request care as well for services. And so in terms of services that we provide, it would be just like your standard outpatient clinics that you see in the communities. We're able to provide access to physicians. If there's an additional care that's needed for specialty services, we refer those out. We in-house have infirmary care at a couple of different sites to provide services for those folks that need additional oversight of any significant ailments as well. Oh, and actually, thank you very much for that. Just recently, internally, most folks don't think about the Department of Corrections in terms of behavioral health care. We're actually able to provide hospital-level, inpatient-level, similar to API, care for our behavioral health folks as well. So we have a men's inpatient unit at Anchorage Correctional Complex. And then just recently, with help from the trust, we are actually able at Highland Mountain Correctional Facility to open up an integrated care unit. And that's a combination of a women's infirmary to create parity between our men's and women's care, and also a expansion of our mental health services there, which really created a much more therapeutic environment for our severe and persistent mentally ill folks.
Follow up.
Oh, thank you for that information. Obviously, I'm wondering about when we have had loss of life and ways that we can have in a system. There's usually something like, I'm trying to think of the word, where there's follow-up, there's a check. You know, someone does an assessment, and then when you're finding out there's a gap in service, we've been having more loss of life than we would ever want. How is the department working to assess that, to have another person do an assessment right away? What is their quality control is not the right word, but when you're in a hospital, you have someone who is doing a double check on the amount of medication you're getting, or those systems. And I think it's really important to know what is the level of assessment and follow-up to that when someone comes in under duress and is needing care?
Through the chair, that is a great question. One of the pieces that we implemented within the last couple of years is we actually upgraded our electronic health record. And one of the key things that we looked at when we were upgrading that were exactly that, mechanisms that can help us track folks that are in our system, whether it be for follow-up for acute needs or actually those chronic care needs. And that's been a system that has helped tremendously to help ensure that we're providing that quality of care. A lot of it, though, I want to be very clear, is that we're dealing with adults, and we want to also promote folks taking responsibility for their own health care, just like you or I are responsible for calling our doctor and saying we need an appointment. We also want to encourage our population to do that as well and empower folks to do that for follow-up care as well.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yes. I guess and just talking about that a little bit more, have you identified some gaps that you have needed to correct when you're doing intake and health assessments?
Through the chair, as we've looked at historical incidents that have happened, historical loss within our system, we are always looking at how we can improve our services. And things that we have changed throughout our history in terms of looking at deaths within our system, we've implemented a new protocol for monitoring our folks that are going through detox. We've implemented the new mental health, the integrated care unit was in response to that. We've increased the number of nursing staff that we've had at facilities. We've increased the number of clinicians that we've had at facilities. So every time there's a loss in our facilities, it impacts our staff. It impacts the folks that provide care within our system. The folks that are coming in our system, the physicians, the mental health clinicians, the nursing staff, they truly are there to provide good care. They obviously could be working in a much more glamorous environment in terms of at an outpatient clinic or in a hospital, but they choose to work for the Department of Corrections. And that in itself is quite a statement to our testament to the quality of folks that we have or the what folks view as their priorities in terms of providing services to an underserved population. And I'm very proud of that. Some of the best mental health clinicians, some of the best physicians and nursing staff that I've ever had the pleasure of working with throughout my career work within the department.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bjorkman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Designee Winkleman, thank you again for joining us today. You testified in answer to the question I had about your vacancy factor affecting your capacity. You also testified about, as to slide 6, you're working really hard to kind of keep your capacity down. What measures are you taking to keep your prison population down and under capacity?
Through the chair to Senator Bjorkman, great question. We look at our daily count on a daily basis. We look at our count on a daily basis. And we have our transportation unit and our classification unit that will pull numbers every single day if things are getting close to a count and determine whether or not, when's their next court hearing, what's their custody level, what might be happening. Sometimes we even have offenders that will volunteer to move if we know we need to move a group of folks to be able to keep capacity down. Did that answer it? It's just sort of an individual basis.
Understood. That certainly answers the facility-to-facility level question. But generally, as the amount of criminals we have in the state is what it is, and your numbers here indicate that you have almost 40% of your bookings are repeat offenders, what practices allow you to keep your capacity, to stay under capacity? While you have 40% that are almost 40% that are repeat offenders.
So through the chair to Senator Bjorkman, the other things that we utilize are going to be our community residential centers, otherwise known as our halfway houses, electronic monitoring for if somebody has can score out to be a community custody level, we can utilize electronic monitoring out in the community. So, you know, that's all part of the population management in moving folks around and determining where they're best housed, the least restrictive environment.
One more question.
Yeah. Senator.
So in your opinion, are there things that are happening throughout the court system or justice in general that are encouraging corrections to let folks out when they shouldn't be out, considering that you have an almost 40% of your bookings are repeat offenders, and you testified that one person got booked in an average of once every 10 days?
Through the chair to Senator Bjorkman, no. We are driven by whatever the court order. There is nothing that we can do without a court order to release somebody or anything like that. So I don't believe those outside factors. Where the outside factor plays into our population management is going to be when, back to our unsentenced population growing, when our unsentenced population has been growing for a myriad of reasons, people coming in on bigger or more egregious charges, and so it takes longer, and so their court hearings will be longer apart or something like that. But as far as population management on a daily basis, we're the downward agency, and the only way we can let somebody out is if we have a piece of paper. There is no pressure to release them to something different.
Senator Bjorkman?
That's all, thank you.
Okay, I think we have one question on this slide from Representative Wright, and then we'll move on to the very last slide.
Through the chair, are there any opportunities or more opportunities for furlough individuals to go to halfway houses? Is that more common now, or is there any barriers to that?
Through the chair to Representative Wright, depending on the area and the location, there will be barriers. So by municipal code in Anchorage, sex offenders cannot release to a halfway house.
Okay.
So for those that are on, they will not be able to go out to any sort of CRC placement, community residential center placement. There is, in statute, domestic violence offenders cannot go on electronic monitoring. And I know I'm wavering a little bit from the halfway house, but there are parameters out there that will prohibit certain offenders being able to go to certain locations.
Okay. Are there any other questions on this slide? We'll move to the last one.
So our final slide is the goals and objectives for the department. And I would note that I have really outlined that I have three main priorities for the department, and that is the health and well-being of the staff. These are tough jobs, absolutely. I feel like I have amazing staff, from our medical staff to our kitchen staff to our maintenance to our admin staff to our officers. And it is going to mean that we need to hire the right people, folks that want to work for the purpose and the mission of working in corrections and be part of something bigger. Getting the culture within the department to realize the idea that reentry is part of public safety, that other end of folks getting out and not having folks come back, it also drives down costs. And quite frankly, they're going to 95% are going to be our neighbors one day. So the health and well-being of staff has to be number one goal. If we have healthier staff, we'll be able to take care of those that are in our care and custody. The next is that folks leave us better than they came to us. And I have been doing this business long enough to know that I am not going to change the world. I am not going to fix everyone. And I know that there are some people that we are safer because they are in custody. I know that. However, sometimes for those that are getting out, those repeat offenders like we talk about that are coming in multiple times, sometimes we're keeping them sober for a period of time. Sometimes they may get a shower that will be the first time they've had a shower in a long time. Others are going to get reunified with their kiddos and get an education. So getting folks to be in a better place than when they came to us is absolutely key. And then the last one on this slide is that to identify efficiencies and resources to reduce recidivism so that we do reduce the numbers that are coming back in the door. There isn't much we can control within corrections, as I mentioned, you know, being that downward agency, but we can work on that, what folks look like on the going out. technology for creating a safer jail gives essentially inmates, if they're able, we talk about the tablets, if there's tablets in there that they can do programming in these times of nationwide labor shortages, maybe they can access some sort of programming while they're able to be on a tablet, that they learn a skill that they'd be able to use when they're back out in the community. Also provides for a safer facility for our officers, and that is also number one. So those are the three main goals. I would be remiss if I didn't talk about inmate deaths. And Representative Story, your questioning, I wanted to make sure that I touched on this as I close this out. We had 18 deaths, and 18 is too many. And that is somebody's son, daughter, family member. I absolutely recognize that. And then the other side, that delicate balance, I've got staff that were working very hard every day to work with offenders that have thrown feces on them, called them names, spit on them, and then had to perform CPR or cut them down from a suicide hanging, attempted suicide. So I have some pretty incredible staff, and I'm balancing the fact that I also know that 18 deaths is too many in a facility, without a doubt. And we have been working really hard on trying to figure out ways to make those differences. As Director Rutherford mentioned, we look at every single death is investigated, and it's investigated by internally by a member. It's kind of a multidisciplinary approach. It's going to be somebody from our security staff, somebody from medical staff, not from that facility where the event happens. It's also going to be investigated by DPS, and the medical examiner is going to look at everything. Last year, we had 18 deaths. 11 of them were for medical reasons. None are undetermined. We have a medical report for all 11 of them. Nearly half were in what we call the end-of-life care. They were in our infirmaries. You would liken it to a hospice care on the outside. It's an inside, so that they are with a medical attendant, essentially. The suicides are something that we definitely, so suicides have gone up everywhere. Then you take a vulnerable population, and that adds a new element to it. And so the National Suicide Prevention Foundation has really targeted, they're calling it Project 2025. They're really targeting the correctional population because they've seen such a rise in suicide within the facilities. And that is actually a little bit to your question, Representative Story, where it is looking at the assessment. We've always used assessments on the front end. The world pivoted a couple of years ago. Is the assessment still providing the information that we need to prevent suicides? And then the audit on the back end. Are we looking at things the way that when something happens, did we look and check all those boxes and make sure that this fits either when we've had a save or when a successful suicide unfortunately happens? Have we looked at all of those factors? We have a staff in the commissioner's office now for wellness. And while it started out as originally the idea was to be a wellness kind of a program coordinator for our staff, and it still will be, they will be working on sort of that piece of that coordination between all of the agencies that look into the deaths when they do occur. One of the biggest parts is really getting the messaging out with regard to the things that we are working on and the information that the media, that the general public is wanting to know. Because we're a medical facility, HIPAA applies. So there's a lot of information we can't give out on the specifics on the deaths. But just last week, or maybe it was the week before now, these weeks start to run together, we just updated our website. And you can look at the history of deaths within the facility. And it does talk to kind of a snapshot of our population. So like I said, number one goal is the health and well-being of our staff that have to work with these individuals. But the same part is that when they are leaving our custody, they're better. And when they pass away in custody, other than end of life for medical, known medical reasons, I realize that that doesn't meet that goal. And so we are working hard to bring those down. And I'll just close with that. I believe the next slide has our drug dogs. And I will note for the record that this is drugs that have been obtained from more than just our facilities. They go out, they help with probation and parole, they help with the DEA, they help with the postal inspector. So this is our canine unit under our Division of Institutions. So I thank the committee for your time. I know we took you over.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Commissioner Designee. I know there are a lot of questions that are still left unanswered along the lines of Representative Story mentioned. We would like to hear, I think, a little bit more about those folks who were in custody, just because it was highlighted news. A lot of folks are asking questions specifically to what information we can get that isn't HIPAA-related or protected information. We probably will get a letter directly to you so that we can get that information to the rest of the committee members. Are there any other questions at this time for the commissioner or deputy commissioner? We have an acting director. We've got a director from HARS, and we also have a director from the Board of Parole, director from the pretrial probation and parole online as well for questions. Okay. Seeing none, just wanted to thank you again for being here. We had Commissioner Designee Jen Winkleman, Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson. Wanted to thanks again for the Department of Public Safety, Commissioner Cockerell, and Deputy Commissioner Barlow. Wanted to thank all the folks who were online. Most of all, thank Committee Chair from the House for having this joint meeting. I think it was productive with the group as a whole. Any questions that any folks have can be directed to our office, and we'll make sure to get answers directly to members. Any other statements, Mr. Chairman? Okay, with that, our next committee meeting in the Senate State Affairs is scheduled for next Tuesday, the 14th at 3:30 p.m. The House is to be determined. Thank you all for being here. And at this time, I adjourn the House Joint Senate State Affairs Committee at 5:12 p.m.